Good morning.
Good morning.
I've had to think about this one. This has been a session that's required a lot of thought over the last year. And in fact, it's built around the most challenging thing I heard last year that I wanted to see what you thought of it. So the centerpiece of this is we're going to listen to 25 minutes of audio, a podcast, talking about this phenomenon called white talk, which I hadn't heard of. And I thought, oh, that's fabulous. Once you name something, it becomes real. And I'll be interested to see what you think of this. So this is in the context of some talks I'm doing this week. I'm Jeff Kersengrip. I'm a professor of communication at the University of Portland. I've been teaching college for 34 years. Figured that out just for you. I'm like, how long have I done this? The 1 year we took off was to live here, actually, in community, first year of our marriage, a while ago. And then I've been at the University of Portland for 20 years, and increasingly my teaching and research have gravitated toward intercultural communication, communicating across barriers, all that sort of stuff has really become my growing edge professionally, and now it's becoming kind of personally too. I find I'm getting really invested in seeing the world in these ways. So this week we talked about, on Monday, just the notion of what is privilege? What does it mean to check such a thing? What's its relationship to something we would call systemically white supremacy? How do those two things play together? On the second session we did, we looked at the contrast between working for racial reconciliation and working to upend white supremacy. Which should be the goal? Are they incompatible goals? Where are we headed? What are we trying to do? And is one of those two, in fact, racial reconciliation, been kind of co-opted as a lens? That was built around a blog post. We watched a film in the middle called Cracking the Codes, which is something you've probably seen excerpts from without knowing that you'd seen it. But it's a really worthy film if you'd like to see it. It's about, I think there's two versions, mostly about an hour and a half done. Today I want to focus on common responses of people of privilege, like me, to being called out or called in about when supremacy shows up or white privilege shows up and I'm on the good side of it and somebody else is not on the good side of it. We have some really reliable ways that we tend to engage those realities, and they aren't necessarily helpful. Now, you have a couple different ways you want to listen to this session. You can listen to it from your own perspective, which is a little more challenging to think, huh, where do I do this? Or you could listen to this as just the story of me. You could just have this be a narcissistic session about the teacher. You could just say, wow, he's had an interesting path, hasn't he? And if that's the way you want to engage it, that works great, too. But however you want to do it, what we're going to do today is I want to explore, first of all, just to let you know some more about what is this? What do we know about how people of privilege often respond when we're called out or called in? And I'll talk about that distinction a little later on around notions of privilege. And then we'll look at some possibilities out there around attitudes, knowledge, and skills, each of which are helpful in moving us to more productive ways to engage those kinds of things. And finally, I'm going to try and get you thinking about what's a better response to recognizing when you're in a privileged situation or when supremacy is really working in your favor. You know, what's the classic thing everybody says when somebody points out privilege? Their response is, oh, I'm just supposed to feel guilty, right? End of discussion. So what we'll end with today are alternatives to that. How else might you engage it or engage somebody else who tries to shut down discussion by saying, oh, you just want me to feel guilty. I don't want to do that. What are some alternatives? And there are lots of them. So you'll be talking to each other a bit. We'll be listening to some artifacts that are pretty interesting, I think. In our particular culture, we're built around a system that it benefits people like me. I'm centered in every identity category there is. I'm straight, male, I'm even tall. I'm white. So there are all kinds of things about me that make for things that don't even, they just look like hallways to me. I walk down hallways, I don't even know there are doors there because they weren't there for me. They were just open, you know, disappeared into the wall, down I went. And I think, what's wrong with you? Keep up. Why can't you get here? Not recognizing that for other folks, doors just automatically are there and there's no obvious handle. There isn't an easy way around those kinds of things. So we're in a culture that does that sort of thing, and it shows up in lots of ways. I want to show you a few artifacts for now that just let you see how this stuff shows up. And, man, I hope this stuff all works. This, I just wanted you to see the headline. This little town in Connecticut decided to award a scholarship to college kids in town based on who could write the best essay just unpacking white privilege. When it shows up, and it turned into this huge firestorm in the town. How dare you talk about, how dare you ask kids to think about the notion of a playing field that is not perfectly level, that is skewed at all. I found that really interesting. And this came across my, came from a friend of mine just a couple days ago. There's a guy on, pulled it apart this morning so you could see the pieces of it. But this is what his premise was, is why U.S.-American white people really hate being called white people. I'm not a person. I'm not a white person. I'm just a person. I don't like this. And what spurred it was Frank Luntz, he's been a Republican pollster for a long time. He posted results of a survey he'd taken around this question: does increased racial diversity have a positive or negative impact on America? And then he split the findings by party. So only 64% of Americans thought it was positive, first of all. 85% of people identified as Democrats did. Look at the Republicans. More than half think increased racial diversity has a negative impact on America today. This is a story from 2 days ago. The author of this post said all these quotes are from him. It's striking for a couple of reasons. The question's not about illegal immigrants or even immigrants at all. It's not about crime or welfare or jobs. It's just about racial diversity as such. That's all. And that was the finding. And so the unstated premise is why I wanted you to see this. This was interesting. That the growing presence of people other than whites in the U.S. is a subject of active political debate, really, rather than just a given. It's not taken for granted. Okay? It's treated as kind of an add-on feature. Is it working, this racial diversity thing? Maybe we should roll it back. Let's discuss. Right? But when you think about that question in the abstract, it's kind of funny. When you think about it more concretely, it gets a little different. So in the case of someone like a person described here, maybe a third-generation American whose parents came from an African country, and now she hears that, at the very least, it's an open question whether her presence and her choice to have children to diversify America is detrimental to her country. Is it bad to have her around at all because she's black? Let's discuss, right? And the third place this author went then was to say, well, first of all, this. It must be alienating to feel like you're on probation and that the people deciding your probation are every white person you meet, and that I have to be so perfect in their eyes before I'll even be listened to, before I can be in the conversation. There's so many ways to be tossed out of the conversation when you're this. We've all experienced this, right? There's a more familiar place where some of you in the room may have experienced this. For example, this. Do you like The Onion? Satire site? Area man will be judge of whether woman actually true baseball fan, saying that he alone could determine the legitimacy of the woman's claim. Area man Luke Hagerty will be the judge of whether co-worker Delia Carroll is actually a true baseball fan, sources confirmed Wednesday. I love The Onion, just the way it works. But think about this, that, you know, I've been in lots of conversations like this, but I wouldn't have pulled it out as a headline. And think about how often there is one group in our culture that is given a certain kind of legitimacy just by existing. So this is the third place the author of this post went, as he said, it occurred to me that white people rarely, if ever, experience questions like this about their very legitimacy. So he did the same question on Twitter. He just immediately posted the same question. Is white people's impact on America positive or negative? And just raised the same question, you know. Should we roll it back? Let's discuss. You know, was sort of the idea. And what's funny is the responses. He said, I went out to walk the dog and came back, and there were like 1,000 responses. He'd been found by the MAGA people, and they were just blah. And the poll, of course, was 82% positive for Americans, proving his point beautifully, for whiteness, right? Proving his point beautifully, that we aren't even capable really of seeing that situation. Do they belong? So we don't really like being called, I'm saying we again, this can be about me, don't really like being called white people. I don't like being reminded that I'm white people, part of a group with discernible boundaries, shared interests, shared responsibilities. One of the benefits of being in the dominant demographic and cultural group is I'm allowed to simply be a person. When I ask my students in intercultural communication or come across barriers, you know, tell me some things about you. Cynthia's done an exercise this week and last week where she asked people to answer the question, who am I, several times. And if you're a person of color, it usually gets in there. You know, if you're a gay person, it's usually something you name on those lists. But if you're a white person, you don't often name race. We do increasingly, but for a long time we really haven't. And to have those kinds of things show up in, to be forced to say, well, you know, but you're white. Well, no, I'm just a normal person, just a regular person. I'm just a person. I'm a mutt. I'm a Heinz 57. What are all the phrases we've used over time to describe how we want to be seen? I don't want to be just another category. Mm-hmm. I have no baggage but what I choose, right? I'm a blank slate. I can write my own individual story. I have no baggage around what I choose. So, examples of alternatives. I remember when I was growing up, somebody asked me if I had a doctor or if I had a woman doctor, right? Right? And so now you go, oh, at that one, times have changed. But we still do the same thing around many sorts of things. And most of us still have these templates in our head. When somebody says doctor to me, my first thought almost always is still of a man. I still see a man, even though I have to, you know, insert the second thought so I'm not surprised every time I hear professor and it's not a man. You know, that sort of stuff going on. Let me finish this one, Jim, and then we'll come back. So all these groups are something people, people with an asterisk. Well, a white heterosexual male is as generic as he chooses. Presence is taken for granted. I like this. White man in khakis and a polo can walk into almost any milieu in the U.S., and even if he's greeted with hostility, be taken seriously. There's something about people like me in that sort of costume just have this kind of weight that others don't have. So the power and privilege that come along with that, being the base model, a person with no asterisk, are invisible to many white people, and that's what today's session is about. What happens when it's made visible to us? That stuff starts to play out interpersonally because it starts to name the behaviors and things that are characteristic of that group. Identity politics, we are the only group that's exempt from that, right? We call other groups out on, hey, you're playing the race card, you're doing identity politics, assuming, of course, we're exempt from that because we have no race. We're just people. You're all asterisk people. How dare you play that card? Do you think a young black man likes walking into a store knowing he's already carrying the weight of those expectations, that he has to behave perfectly? He's probably like to be thinking about tax policy if he didn't have to worry about other things, right? So when we think about people in identity terms, we really narrow what they are enabled to do in many, many kinds of situations. So this is where we're going today, is the bridling that the article mentions. That's something that occurs interpersonally. We bridle with other people out loud. We have responses we use to try and keep ourselves safe and out of these conversations. We'd rather not be there, okay? That I'm the only pure free thinker, free citizen, unburdened, uninfluenced by collective baggage. All you people are special interests, arguing your special interests. I'm just arguing, you know, the way the world is, that that's what we're about. So that's where we're headed here. Jim, is your comment still something you want to add?
Yeah, don't, you know, you said that white people don't like to be called white. Well, don't you think that black people probably don't like to be called black person? I mean,
sure.
To the point we all are just people.
Yeah, my African-American daughter, I'm sure, gets tired of being called black or thought of as black. Should I ask him later? What do you think? What should I do? Let's do that. Let's ignore the default setting, shall we? That's a nice metaphor for today's thing. We'll just go away there. So I want to show you a couple other ways that are relevant to this. So, oh, where did it go? All of my things just disappeared. Lovely. Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. Not yet. Oh, that's why. All right, let's do it another way. Thank you for that guidance. That was astute guidance. Sharon's computer is set up to use Internet Explorer, unlike most people in the United States. Here, we'll just do it from the headlines. So how does some of this stuff play out? This is a really nice little article about how do we handle diversity training. Your company says, oh, we're going to take a day off and do some diversity training. There are some really predictable patterns for how white employees engage diversity training, especially if it's compulsory rather than voluntary. You can find lots of people to mutter with in the room, right, and know that you're in good company of mutterers. So the short answer is, how do we handle diversity training? Not very well. We don't do it very well. Let's see. That one didn't show up, the diversity training. Do you know what tone policing is? Another form of privilege. Maybe somebody is experiencing just a really difficult life, and when they tell you about it, they're pretty mad, or they're sad. And my response is to go, oh, you know, let's talk about this when you're feeling better. You know, hey, don't be mad at me. Hey, I didn't do that. I didn't own any slaves. What's up with you? I thought we were friends. You know, I got to get out of here. So we police the tone by which we are comfortable being in the conversation. And if somebody says, you know, no, you're too angry, you don't get to be as angry as you are if you want to talk to me. I don't have to be in this conversation. I can be out. That's another way that privilege tends to show up, is just in everyday conversation. We enforce pretty high standards to even being involved in it. Let's see if I can get this one to show up. And get bigger. Okay, how do I make it bigger?
So, have you seen, move your pointer down to where, see that plus sign?
That guy?
Click on that, and then you can zoom in.
Wow.
Nice. You guys are good. Now, how do I get back to the top?
Drag. Just put your cursor anywhere in the drag and just drag. Hold it and then drag.
Yeah. So here's a comment. Great. Well done. Oh, great.
It's a picture.
Yeah, there it is. Just click on that.
Boop. So Ward Sutton is a comic for the Boston Globe, and he did a really nice column about, he called it Do the White Thing, as trying to lay out some of the ways that we tend to respond when we're called out. One is we don't focus on the tragedy, we focus on the reaction to it. Oh, it's an epidemic in our society, not the shooting of African-American people who are unarmed, but all these protests. You know, what's up with all these protests? Oh, I don't like a society that's got these protests in it. Or how long before Obama turns into the angry black president? Right, so far so good, but let's not forget that he showed empathy for Trayvon Martin in 2012. Okay, in the current climate, be wary of any African Americans assuming positions of authority. A white cop chokes a black man to death and receives no punishment. Therefore, my nomination for Attorney General is in jeopardy. Are you saying that's a problem? We're worried about those people. How many of you remember this from any of you from the Twin Cities? Do you remember this? It had a name. What was it called? Pointergate. Did you recognize Pointergate? The Minneapolis mayor and an African-American activist had a picture taken with each other, and they were both doing peace signs at the camera, and KSTP actually reported it as gang signs that they were sharing. So the assumption is, you know, anything I don't understand that's done by somebody whose skin color is different than mine is automatically suspect, dangerous, probably gang-related. You really don't remember Pointergate? That's a story that made it all the way out to me. Oh, the fist bump. Yeah, the terrorist fist bump. Well, and I can't get Rand Paul on the screen here, but it says, whenever possible, we talk to avoid the real issue altogether. This was something Rand Paul actually said in response to Eric Garner's death. It's because Eric Garner was selling single cigarettes in a park when he was taken down and killed. If cigarette taxes weren't so high, he wouldn't have been selling them illegally. He'd be alive today. That was the thing to pull out of the thing and have a conversation about. I blame those politicians. Or the hard lesson here, we go back to things we heard as kids. There's a whole menu of things that we do. Sorry, you have to see me doing all this editing today. Let me show you this one. One more here. Get down. This man's a pastor who's really been wrestling with the notion of privilege, and he was comparing it here to the Truman Show, which is a pretty interesting point. Mm-hmm. But, come on.
Jeff, do people know what the Truman Show is?
Oh, it doesn't matter. It was just a movie where somebody was trapped in an alternate reality. That's all. But the point he likes to make is if I am of privilege and society starts shifting in a way that's reducing that privilege, to me, that becomes a full-on attack on me. And so we started to use language to manifest that attack as something like, I'm rich and I'm feeling punished by taxes. That was some of the narrative used to turn the redistribution of wealth from the middle to the wealthy earlier this year. Because the rich were feeling punished by the tax code. Whites believe they're the real victims of racism. Up to 36% of Americans in a recent poll thought that whites are the discriminated against party or racial group in the U.S., up to 36%. Only 16% of Americans believe that there are any racial issues in the country right now at all.
Only how many?
Only 16%. Yeah. That racism isn't a problem. It's just bad people. Yeah, the systemic, that's been solved. Bad people, yeah. There's nothing wrong with the system. Religious freedom is threatened when I can't deny contraception to your employees. English speakers resent bilingualism. I did hear a really, regarding that religious freedom thing that gets cited now, like I should be religiously free to deny you a service that I do, like maybe I bake a cake and you are a gay couple, I don't want to give you that cake. I heard a really interesting interview with a Republican baker in Mississippi who was really angry about this new law in Mississippi that gave people a religious out from having to serve other people. And he said, I'm not aware of any religion, any of the major religions, where it is a centrally held religious belief to deny service to somebody else. In fact, that's the center of pretty much every religion on earth. And he was saying, I bake cakes. People buy my cakes. That's what I do. It's not a religious objection to avoid giving someone a cake. I'm not endorsing you if that happens, especially since that doesn't get carried out.
It was a creative process of making.
Right, that was the argument he went to, right? It was to try and get around that. Oh, let's see. So here's where he goes. The same time, my straight white male sunburn, which is what he's calling the level at which I am pained by this thing, can't be allowed to compete on equal terms with your heart attack. To me, it may seem fair to flip a coin for the first available ambulance, but it really isn't. You know, wait, I've got a sunburn. I got to get going. You know, I need some help. If you've heard the Black Lives Matter response, all lives matter. The cleverest take on that I heard was around when Houston was underwater from all the flooding. And people were saying, you know, I'm with Houston. Houston matters. And people were responding saying, all cities matter. Yeah. And, you know, the people, the all lives matter people who've been pretty quiet lately around the families being torn apart at the border, by the way. Right. Where are the all lives matter people now? We're kind of flummoxed by that. So his take on it, and this is where we're heading today, is many approaches like this one, is acknowledging the distress while continuing to point out the difference in scale of the distress, to say, yeah, you have less privilege than you used to. And let's compare that to what's an everyday reality for somebody who's living in a different space than that. What does this make you want to say or ask at this point? We were just taking the quiz.
I guess I'd like to ask, what do we do about it?
Definitely. Lovely. I love when you give me a segue. Well, let's do this. Let's spend some time with some audio. I invite you to settle in. This is a blog. I guess it's a blog. It's an interview with a philosopher who's coined the term white talk and has done a lot of research around it. When you heard philosopher, what did you picture? It's a woman. Uh-huh. But I saw philosopher and thought, oh, when's the philosopher? Oh, she's the philosopher. Did it again. So I invite you to enjoy this. What I'll ask you to do is hear this. Let me show you this. What we say, bad dog, Ginger. Sit down, Ginger. Blah, blah, blah. And all Ginger hears is blah, 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 Ginger. Blah, 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 Ginger. So I'm inviting you to come up with your own Ginger moments from the audio. Some of it's going to go over you like blah, 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 but much of it's going to stick. And what I'll ask you immediately afterwards are those moments that were your Ginger moments. And also any just sort of responses you have to listening to this piece here. This one I happen to have a transcription as well. So those of you who like to have it in written form, I'll let that go up the screen as well.
I'd like to invite you. I find that really challenging when I listen to it. I heard a lot of myself in it, and I'd invite you to find somebody near you that feels relatively safe to talk about. And would you unpack either your Ginger moment, or if you've got some kind of feeling word or words that capture any part of your response to what you just saw, would you mind sharing that with somebody near you? Start by introducing yourself. Make sure that they know the name of the person they're talking to. And if you find yourself unclaimed, just go like this and whimper. And so, like if all everybody turns away from you, just go, and someone will grab you and you become part of a trio. But let's spend just 5 minutes doing this and then let's pull some stuff out of the bigger.
Okay, folks, can I borrow you? I'll give you back, I promise. My research is all in teaching, and I've come around to believing that teaching is mostly about imposition. It's not about public speaking. It's mostly about you've got these learning machines in front of you who are busy learning something every second of every day, and all you're doing is inserting yourself in the process and saying, stop thinking about that, start thinking about this. And that's a whole set of skills that come along with making people more rather than less willing to go where you want them to go, but they're always learning. They're always learning. Teaching is in some ways so unnatural. To say, stop that natural thing you're doing. So thank you for stopping that natural thing you were doing. Let's extend it into the larger group. I've made two rough columns here, and I'm interested in getting some responses for both from whatever came out of your discussions. We'll do this for 10 minutes or so, and then I've got some resources to share with you that are about attitude, about knowledge, about skill, two of each, that should help you start on having these conversations or continue having these conversations as you've been. For now, though, what should go up here as a record of what sorts of things were in your conversations? I'd like to start above. Anything up there that we could add either to the feels column or the thought column?
Mm-hmm. I saw myself a lot in that first gal that was kind of saying, you know, a lot of my friends are black, and mm-hmm. I'm not racist, and you know, I'm queer, I know how they feel, you know, mm-hmm. just that whole kind of dialogue. And I was telling him up here, I grew up in downtown Washington, D.C., and all my friends were black. We were mm-hmm. the only white people in the neighborhood. So I have kind of used that line. Mm-hmm. Like, how could I be racist? All my friends were black, mm-hmm. and I still have lots of black friends.
Yeah, I got this card, see? Yeah, exactly. Me too.
So I could relate to that.
Thank you. You don't have to. I'm so often looking down here, I just got myself to look up, and I should probably make sure you want to say anything. What else? What's in here? Oh, she does. Hallelujah.
Yeah. Thoughts-wise, I mean, I appreciated the epistemic, just kind of like the
closure.
Small epistemic closure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that label for things that yeah. I've seen and experienced. And the feels, I felt sadness a lot.
Can you say a word about the sadness? Sadness about what?
Again, with the epistemic closure, just realizing how on, like in certain conversations, I have been closed off from knowledge based on my reactions. Mm-hmm. And then also reflecting and feeling sad that when I got messages that, okay, I'm not going to share these parts of my life with you based on the epistemic closure. So I've like done both.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like a loss in both directions, right?
Yeah.
When that conversation stops, not only am I protected from learning something new, but the other person's protected, I guess, from developing a relationship that otherwise might develop into something really new, newsworthy, noteworthy. Chris?
So I found myself a big, huge question in my brain, which was adding on to that, just like how trying to learn and listen to how to not do the closing down of the conversation, but then going back to what I heard you and others in your presentation in the last couple days saying about, you can't just say, but wait, I want to learn about this. Mm-hmm. Talk to me. Aren't I your friend? Mm-hmm. Like, basically, I'm coming away sort of feeling like, so I don't know how to start this conversation or be in this mm-hmm. conversation or respond. Because everything that I feel like I would just do naturally is sort of like I'm genuinely trying to learn. I want to be active.
Does to me. Sorry, that took a while. Is that fair? Is that a decent?
Yeah.
But my good motives are there. They're not by themselves enough, so I got to exercise my skills, but my skills themselves also are kind of rooted in some assumptions about who and what, who's yes. entitled to say which things, when, to whom, for how long.
Yeah.
Sir Ralph?
Yes, sir.
A few years ago, we were driving in the South, and perhaps we should have expected what we saw. We were in the town of the University of Southern Mississippi, mm-hmm. and we stayed overnight, and we noticed an ice cream shop, DQ, across the street, and we walked over there for a treat. We sat down and ordered and got a thing, and I mentioned, well, wait, look around. All the servers, everybody that were workers mm-hmm. in this particular DQ were black, mm-hmm. African American. Mm-hmm. And so, we didn't probably make a big decision about that, but that we were white and they were black, and we were not too astonished at whether we might have been, mm-hmm. but we were kind of wondering. Mm-hmm. You're always wondering. But then he turned it around. All these signs were black come into our all white world. Mm-hmm. Holy cow, what are they thinking about? Mm-hmm. Are they thinking it's going to be feasible when they walk in like that?
Mm-hmm. There were some photos published, I think three photos within the last year. I forget who put them out, but somebody who had set up reverse scenarios. For example, a nail salon where all the customers were Vietnamese and all of the people doing the pedicures and manicures were Anglo-American women. Or Anglo-American men, I forget what they were doing. But they did this in two or three different scenarios just to get people to go, oh, I've never seen that. I have never seen that flipped ratio. I've never been in a DQ where all of the customers were white, or all of the workers were white, and all of the customers were black, for example. Jeffrey.
I'd like to build on Ralph's observation that what I shared with Larry here was when the Black Lives Matter came into my white world, it was an imposition. You know, oh, they're stopping traffic, they shut down the airport, Mall of America booted them out, you know. Thanks, Ralph, for naming that as a, coming into my white world. And my white response, and I'm going out on a limb here to grow and to share
this. Yay! Good for you, Jeff.
Is that, okay, I'm going to get my buddies, and we're going to make some signs, and we're going to go down to 14th and Lake Street, and my signs are going to say, love thy neighbor, stop shooting each other, quit dealing drugs, be nice to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I just recognize that as white talk. And mm-hmm. now, I don't think that would be here.
Mm-hmm. Right? Good on you. Good on you to think it. Good on you to say it. By the way, thank you for all like coming to this, right? You're at a talk on, we're talking about how we talk about racism. This isn't a conversation much of the country is eager to have or able to have. And that's exactly the kind of thing. When they're talking about vulnerability rather than arrogance in a response, that the first response wasn't a listening response, right? Oh, we know exactly what we're going to say. We're going to go say this. And now what I hear you saying is, I wonder what I would say if I really wanted to be in that conversation. Thank you.
For me, it's personal. I think it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. And I live in Pasadena, California. Mm-hmm. And my daughters went to Pasadena High School. They're 20% white. Mm-hmm. Because the other white people in Pasadena went to private schools. And because my daughters went to Pasadena High School, they have friends still. They are their best friends. Mm-hmm. They went to college, but it wasn't as diverse. And their high school friends are their best friends. And they're ethnically diverse, and they're religiously diverse, and they're their best friends still. And they're 42 and 44. But yeah. They came to our house, you know, after football games, and sat on the floor and rewatched the game or talked and had Cokes and whatever. But it was just relationships are what are so important.
I wish everybody in here, could see your face as you're telling that story. That you are delighted about this reality for those people in your life. You are delighted by it. Delighted. So I want to raise the flip side question of that. So what's lost? Epistemic closure. So what? Can you name it? I'm just raising it as a legitimate question. So if we do epistemic closure, so what? What do we miss out?
I guess this kind of.
As the end of the story.
Well, we can retreat. That's not okay because whether or not you're aware of it, people are suffering because of it, and they will continue to suffer until you speak up. And it's also really important to acknowledge that some white people will only listen to other white people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if you are aware of something, you have to do something about it because there are consequences, and it's a tragedy. To ever be mistreated along the whole spectrum because of something that isn't bad or not.
So
it can't just be I feel bad because I'm doing a talk.
Right.
Even though it's bad to be obviously.
Yeah. It's a start but not an end, right? One of the resources earlier this week talked about we tend to confuse white catharsis with systemic change. I now have a black best friend, we understand each other really well, and we talk about a lot of things I never could have talked about before, implicitly saying, the end, I'm there now. That's it. Another example in class I use, our kids will talk about, I don't mind seeing those kinds of people in my community, I just wish they wouldn't push themselves on me. And they should fix that for me, and it's the third piece that's wrong. The work, the emotional labor that was mentioned here, we always put it on the people who are on the margins, and say, I'm uncomfortable with you. Do something about that, because my comfort matters overall, right? It's my work that needs to happen. So separating the personal from the systemic has a downside. It also has an upside to realize, I don't have to feel personally awful to agree to be part of this conversation, to agree to want to solve the problem. In fact, I've got a video to show you in a couple minutes, I think, that will get you to a point there. Professor.
No, I'm just kind of thinking of what I was saying, Chuck and Kurt. A number of years ago, I was in a sort of religious affairs program at BBC, and I just openly said, I'm a recovering sectarian bigot. So I'm putting my cards on the table. For a number of years in my life, I was quite delighted to see Catholics being assassinated by my side. It was part of my story. They were the enemy. And there's something about naming this. I think a conversation in America is too pristine and too nice. I think you need much more brutal honesty around this conversation. And I want to introduce the word that all of us in this room are capable of being racist. I don't know you, wrong time, wrong place. And I often say to myself, well, David, you know, could kind of ear in a little bit of extramarital sex and a little bit of murder, and then he ends up writing quite a sizable number of the Psalms, there's a reasonable chance some of us lesser mortals may do the same. So can I just appeal for a little bit of honesty? Wrong time, wrong place. We are all capable of this.
Beautiful.
Stop being so nice.
You're providing beautiful segues again. Here's a two-minute video on exactly what you're raising here and about that maybe we're being too nice. Here's a response that I think you might enjoy.
Racism is a business. For centuries, it has underpinned global economic exploitation.
Okay. They're trying to get multiple messages in on you there while you're still listening. So I want to make sure that I get you these resources before we go. These are conversations I'm taking my cue from Reverend Mason this week and saying, you know what? I'm raising more questions than offering answers. But I do have some things that you can take away and chew on. Some of them are physical. But I want to offer you two attitudes. I want to offer you a set of knowledge that I found really helpful. And I want to offer you a couple of skills that are really great for being in these conversations. There's lots more to go on your imaginary whiteboard when you walk away from this. And the person you've just been talking to, you still know their name. They're still in this community. We are all trapped together. So you can continue those conversations and unpack them some. But I want to introduce to you, first of all, two things to think about around attitudes that we can change. One is simply rethinking what it means to be equitable. Okay, let's see if we can get that to turn up. We can. This one really appealed to me for some reason. It's not entirely true, right? Some of the things that we're wrestling over are, in fact, resources. Our Congress right now just gave a bunch of resources from one part of society to another one for the, you know, the foreseeable future. So some of the stuff we are wrestling about is that. But much of the stuff that we've been talking about today is not necessarily just that. These are people just trying to be on par in conversation with us. And making equal rights for one group doesn't necessarily mean your rights become lesser. In fact, your experience becomes richer. That's one kind of attitude shift you can make, is to reframe what does it mean to have equal rights. Here's another one, is to reframe what the other is. How do you think about the other in a way that is different than the standard frame we're presented? Here's a three-minute piece from Denmark.
There's us, and there's them. The hirelings, and those just getting by. Those we trust, and those we try to avoid. There's the new Danes, and those who've always been here. The people from the countryside, and those who've never seen a cow. The religious, and the self-confident. There are those we share something with, and those we don't share anything with. Of others. We who have found the meaning of life, and we who have saved lives. And then there's all of us who just love Denmark. So maybe there's more that brings us together than we think. TV2 Denmark.
Of course it's a TV ad. But that's actually, there's a whole school of research out there in something called intergroup contact. You've all heard something called the contact hypothesis. Like, you're biased against those people until you meet one of them. One of your best friends growing up turns out to be gay, right? And you not really liked gay people. The story's been, they're bad. And, oh, but this is my friend and I love her. And in the process of connecting with that person, if it's done correctly, my prejudice toward all members of that group goes down, and it also plays out to different groups, right? I reduce prejudice toward that group based on one bit of productive contact with a member of one of them. It's a really interesting phenomenon, but it has to be done right. That's why we have 40 years of research on contact, because you can also cement prejudices through those kinds of contacts. There's about 8 or 9 conditions that have to be in place for that to happen. But what this video is getting at is one of the ways we know works really well, an attitude adjustment you can make, is to don't just go with the story of the person you're being given. And to try and invent for yourself other stories for that person, other ways to think about them, other places that you are grouped with them instead of against them. Are there ways that I could see you as one of me instead of other than me? How many different ways can I talk myself into seeing you? The most prosaic example I use in class is every time I get a really tall guy in my class, I get a basketball player sometimes, University of Portland. I had a 7-footer this last year. Philip from Germany. And I'd find out what else. I wanted to find out something important about him. He didn't mind being tall. He liked actually being tall. He didn't mind me calling on him as the tall guy. But I had a really tall guy named John. It was 7'1". And I found out he was a poet. And every time I'd call on him in class, I'd say, John the poet. John the poet. It's just sort of a constant reinforcement for him and everyone else that, you know, I'm working hard to see you as something other than this amazingly tall person who reminds me of what it must be like to be a woman in America. You know? You're always looking up at people. So thinking about that, this is based in that sort of research, is to say when you can redefine boundaries in any one of 3 or 4 ways, that's an attitude adjustment that's actually pretty commonly works a bit. Let's look at a couple techniques. Do you mind sharing, getting these out to people? And let's start these this way. Don't forget the people upstairs. They're going to have to somehow dangle tentacles to get these. Can you do it? One is a two-sided single sheet, and I wanted to show you that it's related to a site I think you'll enjoy. Let's see if I can find that. Here it is. How many of you have seen this site before? Any of you educated in education? Run across this one, any of you? It's a really nicely done piece. It's for a white audience, for a white teaching audience in the U.S. in particular. What you've got on the back side or front side, I guess whoever you see it, of the single sheet is just a summary of her points. But when you go to this website, if you just search for it, you'll find her elaborating on each one and actually telling you some about people's responses to some of each one. So again, this is part of the conversation starting, not the conversation ending. I wanted to point you to this resource as some knowledge. This is somebody doing a nice job of synthesizing a lot of what we know about from the social science, from good practice, about how it is that you navigate in environments like that where you are in charge, right? You're the one who's running the room, both content-wise, relationally, and in terms of identity. What are some things that you can have in mind when additionally in the equation is this idea of race? Instead of just freezing up or doing that epistemic closure, some version of it, these are all tips that are designed to help you see things in a way that are less that way. Now it's too big. Can you help me make it smaller again, computer-wise people?
Go on the upper right-hand corner to the...
Oh. Yeah, we didn't get that advice from my kids. It usually comes with, you know, front or back. All right, so this is one. Right, so here are the claims she's making, and she's also talking about things like this. Now, the site's been up long enough that she's able to include now in the site comments from users of the site where they've been especially challenged. So it's got kind of a couple layers of satisfaction. You can find other people who maybe are experiencing your own kind of bits of Velcro or hesitancy or friction or whatever with the advice and what she's suggesting you do. For example, if you have trouble with number two, that there's no such thing as reverse racism, I'd encourage you to skip ahead to number eight and check out the part about centering whiteness. So you're seeing all these here. I wanted you to have this available to you as you see it. So in terms of attitudes, we talked about a couple. One is, can you reframe what our job actually is? What are we trying to do? We're not trying to become nicer people with each other. In fact, sometimes you have to be kind of a jerk to be in conversations where jerkdom is needed, maybe with other people like me, to try and twist the system in a way that fits, right? It's a systemic conversation that we're in. That's one of the attitudes to shift. And the other kind of attitudinal reframing is, how else could I think about others? Are there ways I'm not thinking about yet to frame people I'm currently seeing as others? And does that somehow ease my path into staying in conversation with them, to doing something with them there? In terms of knowledges, there's a difference between being non-racist and anti-racist. You saw a nice concise 2-minute piece on that. And then just this piece here, from this teacher scholar who's laying this stuff out for you. Finally, I'd like to look at two techniques. One is the stapled page, and this is a good one to look at later. I really was really delighted to find this one, because first of all, I love the picture that they chose for it and the little graphic. Todd, I'm going to have to go ahead and disagree with you there. And they even spelled it ya. I think that's an important part of having that conversation. If I said, Todd, I think I'm going to have to disagree with you there, that's not going to go over as well as if I say, yeah, there, right? But these are kind of fun. So just it's examples of certain kinds of white talk and actually some suggested responses. So it's a kind of a starter kit. Like, well, I'm in a conversation, somebody says or does a thing like that. Oh, maybe I'll try one of these. This could be pretty interesting. He crowdsourced it. So when they created it, then they sent it out and said, what are we missing? And they started adding just a couple, three more. So I wanted you to have that as a resource. This, of course, is an online resource. But the one I'd most like to commend to you before we talk, field your questions here, if there are time for any, is the one that's entitled Claim, C-L-A-I-M, on the back. This is the one I did. We have to do podcasts while we're here. I did a podcast on just this one this time because I really like this one. It's really straightforward. One of my students actually found this one this term, and she really liked it and really talked it up to the class. But to recognize, what's the difference for you between being called out and being called in? Anybody recognize that difference? Could talk about it? What does it mean to be called out on something or called in on something?
Called out means someone's pointing out something wrong that you're doing. Mm-hmm. Called in is being invited into the conversation.
Beautiful. And what this technique is inviting you to do is to take whatever you're being offered. Even if you're being called out, you're talking yourself into being treated as though you're being called in. Sometimes you are being called in. People are taking the trouble to point something out instead of just being pissed off at you and going off to tell their friend what a jerk you are, right? They're taking the trouble to engage you in a relatively uncomfortable conversation. This isn't asking you to do very much, but to center yourself and remember, I'm not being attacked. I actually am a good person. They aren't saying I'm a bad person. There's something that happened. Something I did, maybe that's a harm I didn't see, and this person wants me to know that. Can I get myself in that space, first of all? That's the C. L is, Jeff, this is what you were talking about, is your response, is I went to, oh, now I want to listen, right? Instead of like, oh, I know what I want to say, I know what I want to do. Alternately, you're thinking, well, don't interrupt or think of ways to defend yourself. Just listen. Be in the space as a hearer, as a listener. And then, instead of explaining why you did it, which we are great explainers, simply acknowledge and apologize if that's called for or wanted. When I left Holden Village, before we left Holden Village, a longtime resident left, this Danish man, who'd maybe 55 years old, 60. And when Sven left, you know, you give sort of a talk to the community about what you learned, and I thought it was going to be this, you know, kind of long talk. I should have known better with Sven. But he said, well, I learned to say thank you a lot. And I learned to say, I'm sorry, if I thought I had offended anybody. And I learned not to explain. Thank you. You know, that was it. And that's the one speech of all the ones I heard that I remember. Because my temptation is always to explain. Somebody's offended you, like, oh, I was having a bad day. You know, oh, geez, I was such a bad space. You know, I'm sorry, I might get there. But there's the explanation on it. Just cut that off. Don't worry about explaining. Just listen, acknowledge, and engage whatever it is they're offering you. the I, by the way, is in parentheses here because if they consent and have the time and resources, this acknowledges the emotional labor we put on people who often are others, that you're my other. So I can ask you every question I've ever had about othering in this way. Can I touch your hair? You know? Can you fix this for me? My wife has a friend who says, I wish, an African-American friend who says, I wish I could set aside one day a month where I explain black hair to people. You know, how you take care of it, how it feels, you know, every question people have about it. Just set aside one day a month and I'll do that labor that day. But the I piece is, maybe you can inquire, but that's what the parentheses mean. Maybe I just have to sit with this. Like, oh, I learned something, I'm acknowledging it at the end. And moving forward, the best apology is change behavior. If they give you reasonable recommendations, or amends even, do them. Why not? Why not? And that it's a really, I found this a really nice way, and she did too, the woman who found this for me, of just kind of decentering the emotion from it. When I started this week, I said one of my goals in titling this series, Checking Your Privilege, was that people would leave the series feeling like checking my privilege is just as mundane as checking my oil, checking my bank account, checking my pantry. We don't get all head up about those things, right? So why do we get head up about checking our privilege? Well, there's a lot of forces out there trying to keep us from checking our privilege. And so if you can get yourself in that same kind of emotional space about it, it's often really productive. It's a nice way to go. So resources to take away, conversations to have, questions to raise with yourself and other people. We have time for one or two things that you would like to add for the good of company before we head off to lunch. Anything anybody would like to say? Yeah?
Are you familiar with the intercultural development inventory?
I am.
Is that something that you think is helpful?
It's a kind of reflection that can be really useful. The intercultural development inventory is one of several tests out there that lets you know your tendencies, which ones are commonly cultural. We think of ourselves as free agents. You know, I'm just operating because I am this sort of person. If you look at the values of cultures that you swim in, you often find yourself a deeply cultural being. And that's one of the ways you can find that out, is to say, oh, I honor these values and so do most Americans. Oh, geez, I'm much more identical than I thought I was. Mm-hmm. Which then gets me more into the conversations we've been talking about. I'm not the outlier. I'm right in the middle of this.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about doing this sort of work, I mean, personally, it's sort of like, yeah, but how often do I actually talk to a black person or a person of color?
Who's around my table?
Or who's different, who's at the table. And so I also think, you know, in terms of how do we, and that systemic piece feels really important. Mm-hmm. That as people of faith and people in Christian communities, you know, how do we engage at that broader level too? Mm-hmm. Because it's right. So easy to say, well, you know, I'm nice to everybody in this little Roger. So it's just a question or a thought
right.
I want to continue to explore.
Yeah, the film we talked about on Wednesday, Tuesday, whatever. Holden doesn't have days, right? It's just one big blur of time. Somewhere earlier in the blur of time, we're talking about how we still do segregation. We do a lot of self-segregating. So even though most of my sessions have been centered around the interpersonal levers we can work, because that's my expertise and what I know. I believe those things have impacts further up systems, but I also think it's important when you have a choice between segregating and not segregating. Where are we going to dinner? You know, which of the two protests should we go to this weekend? You know, just things like that. To think about not necessarily segregating in the ways that we've always done, to do some things even at one level up, maybe organizationally, that aren't as self-segregating. All right, it's lunchtime. That means lots of time for talking. Thank you for coming to the session. Some of you have been coming all week, and I'm really proud of you for doing that, talking about privilege on your vacation. You know, that's really an odd thing. So thanks very much.